It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. Extension entomologist Donald Lewis joins extension horticulturist Richard Giron today to answer your questions about the plants and insects in your life. On this edition, you'll hear why it's time to start watching for Japanese beetles. And do your linden trees seem to be buzzing? Yes, audibly buzzing? We'll explain. Call in with your questions at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, from buds to bugs, coming up after the news. It's Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We're talking plants and insects with extension horticulturist Richard Giron and extension entomologist Donald Lewis. They'll take your questions about anything you want to grow or grow better. Call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And good morning, it is.
Good morning.
It's still morning.
Good morning.
Richard and
kind of dark here, though.
But. Is it? Yes, I know. There are the thunderstorm watches and warnings in effect for today, so people should be on the watch. I'd like to go into our first talking about things here is the emerald ash borer update, Donald, because earlier this week, and maybe it was just the other day, that Iowa Agriculture Secretary Bill Northey informed us that people should be checking for firewood and campsites and others to make sure that they're not moving wood in from other counties. And also, I think he mentioned it's important to, when you start to plant trees, to make sure you plant in diversity now, to look for diversity in planting trees to stave off potential or future infestation. So I was just going to get your take on all this.
Well, diversity in our plantings has been something we should have learned back in the 1950s when we lost most of our American elm trees to Dutch elm disease. But we loved those green ash trees, and they grew fast, and they usually did well for us, even on some of our poorer sites. And so we planted a lot of those, and since 2002, with the discovery of the emerald ash borer in Detroit, Michigan, that resource, the ash trees of the country, have been under threat. Earlier this year, Iowa became the 15th state in the United States to have emerald ash borer confirmed on its soil. Now, just to make it perfectly clear, the only place in Iowa that the emerald ash borer has been found is an island in the Mississippi River, 2 miles south of Minnesota. So that is way far away for almost all of Iowa, and to this point, we still have not found additional emerald ash borers. We are at the time when the beetles would be emerging from infested trees, and as you move around campgrounds, and especially if you're on the eastern side of the state of Iowa, you may notice these fairly large purple boxes hanging in trees, and those purple sticky traps are attractive to the emerald ash borer, and that is one of the detection methods that's used by this multi-agency consortium that is looking for and working on the issue of the emerald ash borer. This week's announcement was that the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship has drawn a blue line around Alamakee County, and Alamakee is the county in the farthest northeast corner of the state where the emerald ash borer has been found on Iowa soil, and it is now prohibited to move firewood, ash logs, large wood chips out of Alamakee County into other parts of the state of Iowa unless they are inspected and certified free of emerald ash borer. Just like there's a blue line around the state of Illinois, there's a blue line around St. Paul, Minnesota, the state of Iowa, it is prohibited to move ash products out of those known infested areas. And that quarantine is our best defense against the spread of this insect. And so I'm counting on it being decades before the rest of the state sees the emerald ash borer, because we're going to do what we're supposed to do as good citizens, and that is stop the movement by not bringing firewood from other areas.
Okay, that's good. Thanks for bringing us up to date on that. And again, the importance of diversity in planting trees, different kinds of trees and plants. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. It's Horticulture Day. We probably should, on the back of this, talk now about the Japanese beetles because we're talking bugs, and it's time to start watching for those beetles as well. They don't have the threat, I guess, that the emerald ash borer poses, or do they? I don't think they do, but maybe you bring us up to date on that.
Well, the Japanese beetle has been in the United States since 1916. It's another invasive species. It was brought here from another part of the world. When it got here, it just went nuts. The Japanese beetle is the June bug type of beetle that appears in the end of June throughout July, and then it feeds on the foliage, flowers, and fruits of over 350 different species of plants, starting with your rosebuds, your grape leaves, and your linden tree leaves. And because it feeds on the temporary tissues of the plant, that is, the leaves, the flowers, the fruits, because it's feeding on what are temporary tissues anyway, it's destructive, it's ugly, it's despicable, but it's not fatal to the plants under most circumstances. So we're not talking the same degree of threat that we have. But we've had our first reports. We always talk about Japanese beetles appearing in late June, and here we are at June 18th, and we've already heard from some people who have found the very earliest stragglers appearing on their shrubs in their landscape. So, yes, now is the time to start looking for Japanese beetles on your roses, on your grapevines, your linden trees, the raspberry bushes, and elsewhere in the garden.
Okay. 1-866-780-9100 if you want to ask Extension entomologist Donald Lewis a question or Extension horticulturist Richard Giron a question about the plants and insects. We'll go now to Christy in Wisconsin. You're calling from Wisconsin, Christy. Welcome to the program. What's your question?
Thank you. I live pretty close to Dubuque, but I'm in Wisconsin.
Okay.
I think I have finally discovered what is making my delphiniums look so sad and ugly. I've been on the internet, and it looks like I might have an infestation of broad mite or cyclamen mite, according to the pictures I saw.
Yeah, you could, but those aren't really common this far north. Cyclamen mite does attack African violets. We get that as a greenhouse pest, and it could be that the delphiniums have inherited some from somewhere else. But let's back up and ask, what's wrong with the delphiniums specifically? What are they doing or not doing that you wanted them to do?
Okay. Actually, last year, on the blossoms of one, there was just like black splotches. And this year, the leaves also had black splotches and sort of curled up. And now all the way down the row, I have two rows of beautiful plants, or I had two rows of beautiful plants. All the way down the row, the leaves are affected like this, and most of the blossoms are affected, and on some of the plants, they're not even opening up. And on this website, I saw a picture that really looked like it, especially the splotches on the blossoms.
Okay. Mites are a possibility. We could also look for thrips in those blossoms.
Mm-hmm.
What about virus, Richard? That almost, with the symptomatic or the system-wide effect,
yeah,
sounds like virus, too.
It could be a leaf spot or some type of disease. You might want to send a plant sample into the Plant Disease Clinic here at Iowa State, or possibly the one at Wisconsin.
Right. Mm-hmm. Let's
and see if they can identify that. Or maybe go on the web, find their web address, maybe send them some photographs, some digital photographs of the
right
actual foliage and flowers.
Yeah.
And that may be enough. Sometimes it is. And so you can do that. And if that's not sufficient, then maybe send an actual sample in to a clinic.
I think we can start with that in this particular situation, since you moved west and called us instead of going east with your question. Go ahead and send me some digital pictures showing sort of the row and showing the leaves and showing the blossoms. And whenever anybody's welcome to do this, by the way, you can send us digital pictures and we'll do what we can with those. We don't charge for making a guess based on your pictures. But when you take a picture of either a plant or an insect, or you're trying to show us some symptom, there are three requirements for that photograph. Requirement number one is it has to be in focus. And requirement number two is it has to be in focus. And requirement number three is it has to be in focus. So if you send us blurry pictures, you get a blurry answer.
Sure.
So the clearer the picture, the clearer our answer might be to you. The email that we use for all of these types of questions related to insects and potential insect damage on plants is insects, I-N-S-E-C-T-S, plural, insects, and then the little at sign, iastate.edu.
Okay.
And if it's not an insect question, I may forward it to the Hortline answer, the Hortline email, or I may forward it to the sick plant email. And we can keep these pictures moving through the internet for decades if we need to come up with a better answer than what you're getting over the radio.
How's that sound, Christy?
That sounds great, but I do have just theoretically, if it is this mite or some kind of, if I destroy all of the plants that are there right now, which actually I've done with about half of them, if I just cut them down, and I've got new growth coming up, do I just have to destroy the whole plant, or is there something I can do with that new growth to keep it safe?
If it's a mite, insecticidal soap on the new growth so that it penetrates into the cracks and crevices might demitify the new growth, and that's what I would use. I would just buy insecticidal soap and mix it according to label directions.
Sure.
If it's a virus or something systemic, then we have to go and get every little piece of root hair out of the ground to get rid of it. But before we dig out the heavy excavation equipment, let's look at the photos and see what we can figure out.
Okay. Thank you for your help.
Thanks, for Christy. We appreciate the call.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. You're listening to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day with Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis. If you have a question or comment for them, call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We're going to have to take a very short break. Those of you who are on the line, hope we stay with us. We'll be back in a moment and we'll take your calls. This is Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa. We'll be back in just a moment. Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis taking your questions, 1-866-780-9100 or email talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go right to the phones to Bruce in Waterloo. Bruce, thanks for waiting on the line. What's your question today?
Yes, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
On May 28th, a farmer sprayed my fence row with herbicide, 3/8 of a mile of fence line, and it was sprayed with a so far an unknown type of herbicide, and it affected my garden 130 feet into my garden, and it got my pepper plants and my tomato plants, but it didn't kill them. It simply deformed their growing points. It also affected tall peas 115 feet in and curled them up pretty badly. My regular garden peas that were about 6 days from harvest, they were not at first, didn't seem like they were affected, but the scattered tall peas that sometimes come in a package with the proper peas, they were curled. And the Extension Service told me that I could go ahead and harvest those peas, which I did, and eat them, which I did. And what the question is should I have eaten those peas, and will I be able to harvest the tomatoes, that is, if they survive? And can I harvest my cherry trees, which are starting to ripen right now? And my kohlrabis, which didn't seem to show any signs, they were low to the ground. Can I harvest those? I've had the Iowa State.
So you want to know if these are safe to eat?
Well, it's been inspected. The ground has been inspected by land stewardship man on Tuesday, but he hasn't gotten back with me about what kind of a herbicide it was, other than we think it's a broadleaf herbicide.
Mm-hmm.
And he thinks that it volatilized on the hot day that it was sprayed, and that's why it came in and affected so much.
These questions are very, very hard to answer because, to begin with, you're not sure exactly what was applied, how much drift occurred, and so there are so many unknowns involved that basically they're very, very hard to answer. Typically, the way that I approach it is if there is something applied, like a herbicide, and within a few days I see quite a bit of damage. The damage is quite severe as far as twisting and curling, maybe blackening of the tissue. If I see extensive damage, I'm going to assume those things are not edible, okay? And I might start over. On the other hand, if I see, let's say, some minor damage on my tomatoes, where there might be some very minor twisting and curling, but the plants very quickly grow out of that, then I'm probably going to assume that's okay because the damage was so minor, so light, that the symptoms are very minor and they quickly outgrow it, then I'm going to probably assume it's okay. But everyone has a different sense of safety, and you may have a different sense of that, and you might decide if you see any damage on any plant that you're not going to eat it. So it's very, very difficult to answer. You kind of base it on the symptoms that occur within like a week or 10 days.
Now, if a plant shows no signs, like my kohlrabi, which were right next to the peas and right next to the rest of the things that were affected, does that mean that the herbicide did not enter them, or does it mean that it just didn't affect the plant's metabolism?
Plants have different tolerances. Of course, the reason we use broadleaf herbicides for controlling things like dandelions in the lawn is those herbicides do not affect grasses. So we know that plants have different tolerances to that. And as a group, tomatoes are always the first to show.
Right. They're very sensitive to your broadleaf herbicides. And if there's any type of drift, you kind of look to them as a sign that something was applied because they are very, very sensitive. Other plants in the garden.
They were still in that cold frame 130 feet away when they got their growing tips deformed.
Well, to sum this up then, Richard, what do you suggest?
It's very, very hard to answer.
Right.
Again, I would base it on the severity of the symptoms. And if the symptoms are widespread, if they're severe, I'm probably not going to use anything from the garden.
Okay.
If a few plants like tomatoes show some minor symptoms and they quickly outgrow it, then I'm thinking everything is probably okay.
And reporting it to the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship is the correct thing to do, and it does take a while for the scientific analysis to take place to find out, to verify what was used, and it will not be a quick answer. So you'll have to be patient with them as well.
Thanks, Bruce. We're going to move
you.
On. Good luck. Bye-bye now. You're listening to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. We'll go to Patty in Des Moines, who's on the line. Patty, welcome to the program.
My mother's lawn, and I have to mispronounce this. Sounds like I'm mispronouncing this. Her hydrangeas plants, bushes, should they be in the sun or the shade?
Well, there are different types.
Uh-oh.
And some prefer partial to full sun, and some prefer partial shade. So do you know what type you have, by chance?
Of course not.
Are these house plants?
No, they're in her yard.
They're in her yard, okay.
Well, if you don't know, let's put them in, let's say, 4 to 6 hours of sun. That should be okay for most types. So if you can find a site that receives 4 to 6 hours of sun, I think that should be okay for most types.
Especially the morning sun.
Morning sun would be preferable over afternoon sun.
Don't put them on the west side of the house. Put them on the north or the east.
Not west. So north or east of her lawn.
So a good site that has, let's say, a well-drained soil, fertile soil, and about 4 to 6 hours of direct sunlight per day.
Well-drained, 4 to 6 hours northeast. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for calling, Patty. Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Bob in Storm Lake. Bob, welcome to the program. We've got a couple of minutes before the break here. What's your question?
I have a quick question.
Okay.
Every year my zucchini gets grubs in it or cutworms, and I don't know what to look for, whether it's like butterflies flying around, but is it too late to start spraying with 7 or something, or what can I do to stop it?
You're on the back side of the egg-laying period of the squash vine borer. Squash vine borer is a moth, but it's one of our more interesting moths because it violates the rule that moths fly at night and butterflies fly during the daytime. This one is a moth, but it flies during the daytime. And if you saw it, you would probably think it was some sort of an orange iridescent wasp out there in the garden. But that female moth is laying her eggs on the stalks of the zucchini plants, the other squash plants. Those eggs hatch into little tiny caterpillars that turn left and take 2 bites and disappear into the stalk and spend the rest of the summer on the inside of the plant.
Yeah.
That's why we spray 7 or our other garden insecticides, especially the residual insecticides, so we don't have to do it so often. We spray those on the stalks beginning in the middle of June. So you may have missed a little bit of the period, but I think you would probably get some benefit from spraying now if you can wait for this rainstorm to pass and then put the insecticide on the base of the plants. We don't need to treat the leaves because the female moth lays her eggs on the base.
Okay. I'll do that.
That sound good, Bob?
Yep.
All right.
Squash vine borer is such an interesting critter. We have this one small family of moths that violate all the rules. Here are moths that are brightly colored. Moths are supposed to be dull. Here's a moth that flies during the daytime. Moths are supposed to fly at night. Here's a moth that has wings that are transparent. And moths are supposed to have fuzzy wings. So it's just such an interesting a piece of life when something violates all the rules and still can fit. So there's a place for public radio, isn't there, Julie?
There definitely is, definitely. All right, thanks for calling, Bob.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. And we're going to take a 5-minute break here for Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. But when we return, we'll take your questions. Extension horticulturist Richard Duran and extension entomologist will be here. Extension entomologist Donald Lewis will be here to take your questions about the plants and insects in your life. 1-866-780-9100 or email us talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. I'm Julie Englander, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Duran and Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis are with us to answer your questions about the plants and insects in your life. If you have questions for them, call in at 1-866-780-9100 or email us talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. And we'll go to the phones. Gene in Orphage, is that where you're calling from, Gene? Hello?
North Central Iowa.
Okay. Yes. All right. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks
for waiting. What's your question today?
Well, before I ask my question, mm-hmm. I have a comment about the man who had garden damage.
Okay.
And
quickly.
About 25 years ago, I had extensive damage to my garden, and the beans and squash and things died. But I was advised by the Extension Service to trim off some of the damage on the tomatoes and wash them off, which I did. And I never had such a crop of tomatoes in my life. The plants were about 6 feet tall.
They were good then.
And just had volumes of tomatoes. and they were nice.
Year.
And I ate them, and I'm still here.
You're still here. You're calling on Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day.
Yes.
Okay. What's
now,
your question?
My question is about marigolds. My neighbor and I have noticed that a lot of the leaves on the marigolds have been eaten, except for the ribs, you know. And what is going on, and should we do anything, or will they recover, or what?
We've had lots of questions and calls about lots of different plants chewed down to the midribs this year, and I think we're just going to have to become nocturnal gardeners. We're going to have to be out there at night with our miner's cap on so we can have a light and have our hands free to see who's there. There's a short list of suspects, and the one that has been extremely abundant in my home garden this year is the variegated cutworm. And I have had more variegated cutworms and more variegated cutworm damage to my hostas this year than I think in the past 10 years combined. Now, it's a cutworm, but it climbs up on the plant and it feeds on the foliage. So that is one possibility, but their cycle is about done. So if we get new leaves on our plants, they should be unaffected. Slugs.
That would be suspect number two.
Slugs is suspect number two because of the wet weather. Well, hasn't it been wet forever, it seems like now, that we've had good moisture in the spring and fall, and the slugs have just been doing a banner job of reproducing and growing. And the slugs also come up at night, and they feed. Now, the damage you're describing doesn't sound exactly like slugs, so maybe that's not it. And then suspect number three is we've got more earwigs than ever before, but they usually don't eat down to the midrib. They nibble on the petals and of various petunias and things like that. So I don't think it's earwigs that you're describing, but I think it's a nocturnal feeder that's out there chewing the leaves off.
I see. Now, what are these little earwigs? Are they something like a large ant?
Oh, well, they don't look like ants to me. They're 1/2 to 5/8 inch long. They're sort of a mottled brown and black. They tend to scamper. And the distinctive characteristic is that on their tail end, they have pinchers. They have long pinchers that are about, 1/4 the length of the body is taken up by these two pinchers on the tail end. And when an earwig runs, they frequently hold those pinchers upright in the air, and they wiggle when they run. And that's where the wig in earwig comes from, is that when they run, they wiggle. So they live in damp locations. They're under the mulch. They're under the leaf litter. They're under the loose bark of dead trees, where they are scavengers feeding mostly on decaying organic matter, but occasionally on plant tissue as well. Most people know earwigs as a household invader. They crawl in under the door, and they make their presence known by staring at you from the kitchen floor when you get up in the morning, and you just flick them back outside and tell them to stay where they're supposed to.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thanks for calling, Gene. We appreciate it. Good luck. Bye-bye. You're listening to Talk of Iowa. We have an email from Christine in Coralville. She wants to know how to rid her garden of horsetail or mare's tail. Richard, are you familiar with this?
Equisetum, yes. It's
like an aquatic plant.
It's an odd-looking plant. Doesn't really have a noticeable leaf.
Looks prehistoric.
Yes, it does. It's kind of like a stalk with maybe 1/4 inch in diameter. That may be 3-4 feet tall, composed of different sections. It's very hard to control because it has a deep root system. And probably the best way to control it would be to go out repeatedly and dig it up and remove as much of that plant tissue as you can, but do it repeatedly. It will require patience, persistence. Herbicides are not very effective in a garden situation, so the best course of action would be to dig it up repeatedly and destroy as much of that plant debris as you can.
Isn't better drainage part of the control for that one as well?
That might help a little bit. Mm-hmm. If you can maybe improve drainage in the area, because it does like very damp situations. Oftentimes you'll see it in roadside ditches where water kind of collects, and it forms these very, very dense colonies. So maybe trying to improve the drainage and repeatedly dig it up.
Okay, sounds good. Thanks. We'll go to Michelle in Van Horn. Michelle, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. What's your question on Horticulture Day?
Well, I noticed on the underside of my maple trees, partially popped popcorn. It looks like little white. Mm-hmm. So I asked, went to a garden center, and they said it was woolly aphids. And I was wondering, could you tell me a little bit about it?
Oh, I hate to argue with garden centers. Tell me how big the popcorn-like growths are on the plant.
I would say if it were popcorn, it would be like one little roundy section. So in other words, a bump on the periphery.
We're
not
talking
like,
yeah, quarter inch, 3/8 inch.
Okay, yes, yeah. That'd be no bigger than that.
Okay, and these are on the foliage or on the stems?
It's on the stems, on the underside of only my maples. My locust, walnuts are not affected.
Right, and it's a silver maple, right? Soft maple?
I don't know.
I'm guessing it is. I'm going to give an alternative diagnosis here. I think what you have is cottony maple scale. And the reason garden centers may not know this is that we have not had an outbreak of cottony maple scale in the lifetime of most of the high school kids who work in garden centers. So they just have not lived long enough to see this. I think the last time we had a good outbreak of cottony maple scale was back in the mid-1990s. So back in about 1995, we saw this. It's a scale insect. It's a little tiny insect that has plugged her beak into the stem, and she's feeding on the sap. And one of the symptoms is lots of honeydew comes off of those infested trees. And then beginning in the end of June, the female creates this mass of cotton. It's almost like a webbing that grows to, the size of your little fingernail, a little larger. And in that are thousands of eggs that are going to hatch into little tiny scale insects that are going to move off and feed on sap from another part. The thing about cottony maple scale is it explodes and then it disappears. And the last explosion was 1995, and here we are in 2010 with another one. So if we just relax, let this one be, whatever nature does to keep this thing under control in the last 15 years is going to happen again if we stay out of the way. And one of the problems is we see these temporary explosions, we see these unusual populations, and we pull the trigger and we spray insecticide and we actually make it worse because we kill the natural enemies that were holding this thing in check. So if we use insecticides and kill the natural enemies, the lady beetles, the predatory wasps, the parasitic wasps, and so forth, then we have to do their job. And if we just left them alone and let them do their job, this thing will return to normal. In the meantime, I can tell you from my experiences back in Ohio, your silver maple tree is going to be fine. The cottony maple scale is not going to hurt the tree. Lightning strike will take it first.
So okay, great.
Good news, Michelle.
Indecision works. Thanks.
Thanks for calling, Michelle. Sounds like it'll be a good ending to it. Bye-bye. We'll go next to Tim in Des Moines. Tim, welcome to Talk of Iowa Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Yeah, I have several eastern redbuds at my business, and then I also have one at home. The ones in my business last spring, they came back nice, and then out of nowhere, the leaves dropped off, and so there's no foliage on it at all. And then about the middle of the summer, new sprouts came off the trunk and up the trunk and some of the older branches. And they're on the edge of a parking lot, and it does get snowplow snow on, built up on the trunks all winter long. And this year, they kind of did the same thing, except they didn't really sprout very much on the new sprouts from last year, and they have started all over again, and they're just not looking good. And I was wondering if there was any way that I could trim those back and get the tree back, or if I just need to get rid of them and plant again.
Boy, I'm not sure that they're ever going to come back again and look nice.
Yeah.
And I think maybe the winter temperatures may have been the main culprit.
Okay.
There may be other things going on, too, as far as it may be kind of a poor growing site. But we've had two very cold winters, the last two winters.
Right.
And red buds are kind of marginally hardy in central Iowa.
Mm-hmm.
We can grow them, but sometimes the trees that we buy are grown from a southern seed source.
Sure.
And they're not as hardy. And so that can be a problem on occasion. So that might be a big part of it.
Okay.
And so if you tried to retain these and we had a couple nice winters, they might be okay. But then again, if we have another hard winter, they may do the very same thing again. So I'm thinking at this point, it might be better just to remove them and plant something else.
Yeah, yeah.
That's kind of my inclination.
And then the one I have at home is doing really, really well, but it's on the edge of a patio, and it needs to be trimmed back, and I was wondering if I could trim it now or when I have to wait.
Yeah, I'd probably wait maybe a few more weeks and maybe do it around mid to late July.
Okay.
Basically after the tree is done growing.
Okay.
And in the future, when you buy a red bud, especially in Iowa, do ask the garden center if these were grown from a northern seed source. That's very important in Iowa that they be grown from a northern seed source to make sure they have the maximum cold hardiness.
Well, these were free, so I didn't have the liberty to ask. So,
well, thanks, Tim.
You bet. Thank you.
Bye-bye now. You're listening to Horticulture Day on Talk of Iowa, 1-866-780-9100. If you have a question for Extension Horticulturist Richard Geron or Extension Entomologist Donald Lewis, we do have a couple of emails. The one from Kay who says there was damage from Japanese beetles to her grapes last year. Is this an indication these plants will again have the beetle infestation? And how is Japanese beetle prevented and controlled?
Not easily is the answer to the last question about how we control Japanese beetle. It's a difficult one.
Okay.
They will always be with us. You can ask New Jersey and the Atlantic seaboard, where it's been present for nearly 100 years now. They still have grapes. They still have roses. But they've learned either to live with them or how to fight them. And we're still in that situation. Japanese beetle has only been found in 46 counties in the state of Iowa, so not everybody knows what we're talking about these red and green hard-shelled beetles that appear in the middle of the summer and eat the foliage, flowers, and fruits. They are about half an inch in length, so they're a moderate-sized insect. While you have a few, and if you have a few plants, hand-picking works, and you just make it your hobby to go out there sort of mid-morning with your little bucket of soapy water, and you tap the plants, and the beetles will fall off into the bucket that you've positioned right under the leaf. So that works for a while, and there is some therapeutic value to that, I suppose. But when you have too many plants and too many beetles, you have to decide whether or not you're going to fight them chemically with an insecticide, and we have sprays at the garden centers. And for our ornamentals, with great reservation on our food crops, but for our ornamentals, there is a systemic insecticide you could put on the soil right now. You better hurry up and do it, so that insecticide goes up through the trunk and is in the foliage, and as the beetles feed on the tree, such as your linden tree, as the beetles feed on the tree, they would eat the insecticide as well. But persistence, you just have to keep at them, either with hand picking or spraying, to keep the foliage on the plants that you really need the foliage on.
Okay. We'll go to Martha now in Riverside area. Martha, welcome to Horticulture Day.
Hi.
Hi.
excuse me. I have a question about ants.
Okay.
We have recently moved to an older, big old house. Anyway, we have these ants crawling around on our kitchen counter and stuff, which normally otherwise would not bother me, but my husband says they're carpenter ants, and apparently we need to get rid of them to protect our house.
Yeah, possibly. So you have a big old house. Do you have big old ants? too?
They're bigger than the, they're not the great big ones, you know, like half inch.
But they're half an inch.
Pardon me?
They are half an inch?
No, they're not those ones. They're more like quarter inch or a little bit bigger. Okay. But, you know, they're big and black. Anyway,
well,
like I say, they don't bother me, but I don't want our house to get eaten up, and I'd rather not use a poison or a chemical if I don't have to.
Well, you're a very tolerant person. I appreciate that. The ants, especially carpenter ants, and more often the larger ones, half inch or slightly larger, they are great wanderers, and they travel long distances from dead stumps and hollow trees and dead limbs where they have their nest inside decaying wood, and they travel long distances looking for food. And those that get into the house seem to love the sink for its moisture and grease, and they love to crawl into the dishwasher. And mostly they're just wanderers passing through, and they're not a sign of an infestation. If you had water damage and you had a decayed windowsill or a door frame or up under the eaves where water has gotten in, the carpenter ants could move in, and they would be taking advantage of that decayed wood in your house, just like they take advantage of decayed wood inside Michelle's hollow silver maple tree. So, yes, they could be in the wall of your house, but it's the moisture that's the problem. The ants are just a symptom that you've got too much moisture in the wood. So there's no easy answer here. If the ants bothered you more, you would spray the outside of the house to try to keep them from getting in. If it gets to be more than just a few, you'll try to track them back to the nest to see if there is a location. If they are in the house, since carpenter ants don't eat wood, they chew it up and throw it away, there should be sawdust accumulating somewhere. And we see that at the base of hollow trees. We see that next to the firewood pile, next to the rotten piece of firewood that's on the ground. And we see that in your house. If they're chewing up your windowsill, sawdust has to be going somewhere. So you'll just watch for more activity. You may need to put on your miner's cap, like we talked to the other people about, and watch these ants at night to see if you can track them back to a location that might need repair, such as replacing windowsills or something where you've got moisture damage from a century of water leaking in.
Okay. Well, it sounds like my first step is to determine if they, in fact, are carpenter ants.
And for that, we'll need a sample, and you're certainly welcome to send them to me on campus. I would tell you to send a digital picture, but you can't take a close enough picture for me to be sure. Unless you've got a really good macro lens on a digital camera, you can't take a close enough picture and keep it in focus for me to see what I need to see on a carpenter ant. But take them to the county extension office there at the fairgrounds in Johnson County at the edge of
Washington
Iowa City.
County, yeah.
And they will they'll send them in for you.
Okay.
All right.
Great. Thank you very. Oh, I have a question about plants.
Real quick.
Poison ivy. How do I get rid of it? Especially, can I do it without chemicals?
Well, basically, you have two options. One option is to dig it up. If it's a small plant, you can do that. The other option would be to use Roundup on it. Those are the two main ways of control.
Okay.
Thanks, Martha. Good luck.
Thanks.
Bye-bye now. We'll go next to Rex in Cedar Rapids. Rex, welcome to the Horticulture Day. What's your question?
Yes, I have a massive infestation of earwigs. They're in my pool. They're invading my home.
Mm-hmm.
And I also have a two-year-old daughter who has just discovered the beauty of the backyard. I was wondering if there is a way to treat without any harmful chemicals that may harm her.
Well, we have insecticides that are not toxic to us. The modern insecticides, bifenthrin, cyfluthrin, permethrin, these are all very low toxicity, and we apply them at very low rates, and the hazard is virtually nil. The difficulty is the insecticide is not going to hurt us, but it's difficult to make it hurt the earwig. Because
yeah.
They live in those damp locations, such as under the mulch, under the leaf debris, under the leaf litter, the cracks between the swimming pool and the ground, every place there's debris laying on the ground. So, in other words, the earwigs are hiding in places
yeah.
we can't treat. And so the insecticides just don't work very well. But when we've got a massive number of them, if you want to try spraying those areas, I would find one of these insecticides at the garden center, mix it up according to label directions, and limit the application to those places where you think the earwigs are hiding. In other words, think like an earwig, assuming they think. The other thing we could all do is stop doing rain dances, and when it dries up and when we get droughts in the summer, like nature intended for Iowa, the earwigs will suffer because they can't handle dry weather. They are favored by all the rain we've had for the last several years. So that's the reason everybody has massive invasions of them. And if you can treat hiding places, you might have an impact on the earwigs, and you will have no impact on the two-year-old daughter.
Okay.
Thanks, Rex. We appreciate the call. We're almost out of time here for Horticulture Day, so I wanted you to answer the question about why linden trees are buzzing.
Oh, they are in bloom, and linden blooms are so sweet and attractive to flies and bees and wasps during the day, and they are attractive to moths at night. So your tree will just be fluttering with insect activity while the linden trees are in bloom. It's quite the show. Go enjoy it.
Okay. Thank you, Donald Lewis, Extension Entomologist, and Extension Horticulturist Richard Giron. We appreciate your expertise. And Horticultural Day will be back next week on Friday, so we hope you join us at that time. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. We had assistance today from Lindsay Moon. I'm Julie Englander. Thanks for joining us.